And now, Pastor Comparé.
I want to talk to you tonight about the day of the Assyrian. You know, the Bible is pre-written history. And as such, being true, it is always consistent. It all runs true to the same theme. The theme of the entire Bible, the entire drama of the ages, is set in Genesis 3, verse 15, where God says to Satan, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. Now the same Hebrew word, zerah, is used for seed or descendants in both cases. So Satan is to have just as literal children in this world as Eve. The rest of the Bible is a development of that theme, of that conflict between good and
This is Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé of San Diego, California. The tape which you are about to hear was produced on high-speed tape duplicating equipment. If it doesn't function well in your player, please return it to us with an explanation of your difficulty and instructions as to whether or not you wish a replacement. In this way, we can discover our recording problems and correct them in the future. Pastor Comparé practiced law in the state of California for many years until retiring to devote full time to the ministry of Jesus Christ and His earthly kingdom. The ability of a skilled lawyer in evaluating evidence, special aptitudes in history and the sciences, and more than 40 years of diligent study have earned Pastor Comparé his reputation as one of the nation's greatest Bible authorities. He has opened the eyes of many to the truth of God's Word, which has been hidden from most Christians by a church system which has fallen under the control of the enemies of Jesus Christ. Your Heritage is dedicated to spreading the gospel of the kingdom of God, a social order in the earth based upon the perfect laws of God rather than the philosophies of fallible men, and to identify the Anglo-Saxon and kindred peoples as the blood descendants of the Israelites of the Bible whom God has chosen to serve Him in this age. We shall be happy to supply you with lists of the literature and recordings which we have available for your personal ministries. We are not part of any organization and depend upon your offerings to cover the expenses of awakening God's Israel sheep to their covenant responsibility of service to Yahweh. Please send your letters and generous contributions to Your Heritage, P.O. Box 5486, San Diego, California, ZIP 92105. Thank you, and now Pastor Comparé.
I want to talk to you tonight about the day of the Assyrian. You know, the Bible is pre-written history. And as such, being true, it is always consistent. It all runs true to the same theme. The theme of the entire Bible, the entire drama of the ages, is set in Genesis 3, verse 15, where God says to Satan, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. Now the same Hebrew word, zerah, is used for seed or descendants in both cases. So Satan is to have just as literal children in this world as Eve. The rest of the Bible is a development of that theme, of that conflict between good and evil, between the children of God and the children of Satan. Now, the identification of Satan's seed is given you very plainly in the Bible. In the 14th chapter of Isaiah, there's a passage beginning with verse 12 and carrying on through verse 21, where there is no possible doubt of who he's talking about, because Isaiah names the party, Lucifer or Satan. It begins, How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Now that mount of the congregation in the sides of the north was Mount Zion, in the northerly part of the city of Jerusalem. Now Mount Zion was the capital hill of Jerusalem. In other words, it was the seat of government in the city. And the Bible throughout uses Zion symbolically as representing the seat of government even long after no trace of this remained in Palestine. So when it's talking about Zion today, it means the seat of government of the great Israel nations, wherever they are, and particularly here. So Satan, besides trying to make himself like God in the heavens, was also planning to take over the government of the Israel people. So there's no doubt now who it's talking about. It's Satan, Lucifer. Now this same passage I've spoken of goes on. This is verse 21. Prepare slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise, nor possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. Now this wasn't disembodied spirits that he was talking about, because mere spooks don't build cities, and you don't have to bother slaughtering them because they're beyond reach of ordinary weapons anyway. That is these literal flesh and blood children of Satan that it's talking about. Now, Jesus Christ himself confirms this in John 8. Beginning verse 31 and continuing right on in one conversation with them through verse 44. Verse 31 identifies who it is he's talking to. It says, "Then said Jesus to those Jews who believed in him." Now remember now, he wasn't just quarreling with these Jews because they didn't believe in him, because these did. I get so disgusted at times when somebody says to me, "Oh, but Mr. Comperé, wouldn't converted Jews be just wonderful?" What do you mean by a converted Jew? One who believes in Jesus Christ, of course. Well, this is who he was talking to. And you remember, he starts out, and you can just barely hear the ring of sarcasm in his voice, because he says, "If ye can continue in my doctrines, then will ye be my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And the truth is just what they don't want any of. And so they start quarreling bitterly within them. So these are Jews now. And that same conversation between them goes on, down through verse 44, where he tells these Jews, these converted Jews, now, he says to them, "Ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." Now I can assure you that Jesus Christ was not simply being vulgarly abusive to these people. He was speaking with scientific, biological accuracy. When he told these Jews they were the children of their father the devil, he was as scientifically accurate as if he had said to a Chinaman, "Your ancestors were Mongolians." It's the same people. The Bible makes this thing clear. These weren't spooks and demons he was talking to. These were altogether too much flesh and blood Jews. Now, you know, of course, that the Jews of that day possessed the same character that they have today, and they behaved the same way as we see. Now, in some places you have been given the entirely mistaken idea that the Semitic type of face is the hook-nosed Jew type. It is not. The ancient civilizations make that very clear. The kings of all the ancient empires were extremely proud of their military conquests, and they left monuments carved on stone celebrating how they captured this city and that one and slaughtered so many of the inhabitants and all that. And besides the inscriptions, they nearly always had carved on these stone monuments panels of illustration showing some of the captives taken from these cities. Now, whenever they showed Israelites, these people had straight-nosed, typically Anglo-Saxon features. And whenever they showed any of the Canaanite peoples around there, such as the Philistines and the Hittites and, yes, even the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they were typical hook-nosed pawn shop Jews. The palaces of Babylonia and Assyria were made with walls of sun-dried brick, just like the adobes that they build here in the southwest. That was the core of the wall. Now they had to have the outside either plastered or faced with a layer of hard burned brick to keep it from washing down in the rainstorms. Then on the inside, the Assyrians at least lined their palaces with remarkably beautiful painted and glazed tile, beautifully decorated. And on these, they pictured themselves in their own activities. Their commercial activities, their priests in their gorgeous robes, they pictured themselves at war and all that sort of thing. And where the Assyrians themselves, not their enemy's caricature of them, but the Assyrians themselves leave portraits of Assyrians in work done for palace walls, which was the product, therefore, of the best artists of the empire, they show them as typical hook-nosed Jews. In other words, the Jew was the demonic mixture, otherwise known as the Canaanite people, and more specifically called by the names of their various cities. Now, this demon mixture was very ancient. It was actually pre-Adamite. As you know, the Tigris-Euphrates valleys in their upper reaches were originally called Akkad, and that was taken over by the Assyrian Empire. The lower portion of it was originally Sumer, and later was called Chaldea, and that became the seat of the Babylonian Empire. The Assyrians were the earliest of all these empires, not the one that you read about mostly, that was a later development. But the Bible tells us that the first Assyrian Empire antedated anything down in Chaldea. In Ezekiel 31, verses 3 to 9, it says this: "Behold, the Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon, with fair branches and forest shade. Its stature was exalted above all the trees of the field, and under its shadow dwelt all great nations." And you know, there's a very accurate simile. You know that plants that have to grow in the shadow of something else don't fare very well. And that was true of the other nations that were under the power of Assyria. It goes on. "The cedars in the garden of God could not hide him, nor any tree in the garden of God was likened to him in his beauty. So that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him." Now, you people who've been coming here for a while know perfectly well that the trees in the garden of Eden were not the ordinary wooden kind that grows in the ground. They were the family trees of nations and races, just as it illustrates here, calling the Assyrian a mighty cedar. And these other family trees of other nations and races and empires were rather small potatoes compared to the Assyrian Empire at the time when the Garden of Eden was there. That's the situation that Adam found when he first came here on earth. You see, the demonic intermixture, the Bible tells you about the angels that kept not their first estate, but came to earth and picked women, all that they chose, and had children by them. This was associated with the original fall of Satan, which occurred before Adam ever came here. It was to overcome that, to throw out the rebel Satan and take command again in the name of God and rule the earth for God's purposes. It was for that that Adam was sent here. Now, it was far earlier than Babylon. We find this confirmed again in the Bible. Babylon first comes into prominence in connection with Nimrod. Nimrod was a grandson of Noah. In Genesis 10, verse 10, it says, "And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel." The Greek form of the word is Babylon, but the Hebrew is Babel. "And Erech, and Akkad, and Chaldee, in the land of Shinar." Well, Shinar is another name for Chaldea or Sumer, the flat southern portion of the Tigris-Euphrates valleys. But so much earlier than this were the Assyrians. Isaiah 23, verse 13 says this, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not until the Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness." They, that is the Assyrians, they set up the towers thereof. They raised the palaces thereof. In other words, in the lower portion of it, it was under Assyrian domination that their earliest civilization was built up there. You know, Cain is a perfectly good historical character. He appears in history as Sargon the First, not the Sargon mentioned in your Bible. That's one who lived some thousands of years later and called himself Sargon the Second. But the original Sargon the First, Sargon the Magnificent, is a perfectly good historical character because archaeologists have dug out of the ruins of some of his cities his own official court records. Not legends about him from centuries later, but the court records made during his own reign. And he can be identified from the names of the cities that he is connected with as Cain of the Bible. Now, when Cain murdered his brother Abel and was driven out, not allowed to remain with his people, the Bible tells you that he went into the land of Nod, and that word Nod means wandering. Well, now you know how in the lower Mississippi Valley it was overflowed by the annual floods until they finally put in tremendous dikes or levees along the sides of it. There are places there today where the surface of the river is flowing along 40 feet above the level of the surrounding land, held in by these dikes. That was the sort of thing that happened in flood season in the lower Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It was a very flat land, and the villages would be washed away periodically every flood, and the people had to flee a long distance to get to high ground, flee for their lives. Hence, it was the land of wandering. And Cain went in there, taught them engineering, taught them how to put up dikes along the river banks and settle down, and eventually that region was more civilized under the power of the ancient Assyrian Empire. And if you're wondering why I'm talking so much about ancient history, it's because I'm trying to show you the roots of present-day history and the history of the next few months. You know, nothing that exists today just happen by itself. The things that exist have their roots in the past. It's just like the leaves up on the top of the tree. They're not just up there hanging by themselves in empty space. Those leaves are connected to twigs, and the twigs are connected to branches, and the branches are connected to the trunk, and that goes down to the roots of the ground. And so everything going on today has its roots in the past. And if you will read what the Bible tells you about the original root of these things and about how it will develop and what it's going to do today, then you aren't going to be surprised by any of the things that happen. Because the Bible is pre-written history. And you can find out what's going to happen shortly by reading it. In fact, mostly in the Old Testament. Well, this earliest Assyrian Empire had collapsed, perhaps earlier than 3500 B.C. And for the next 2200 years, it did not come back into prominence. In that region, Babylon gained varying degrees of power and was generally the most important empire in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys. Then, beginning about 1300 B.C., the Assyrian Empire came back for 7 centuries of power, of incredible brutality and cruelty, and also of incredible greed and rapacity. The characteristics that go with that hook-nosed people. Now, if when you have read about some of these ancient military campaigns, you've thought of the Assyrians as conducting these wars merely for the plunder they could get at the time, you're mistaken. Any good history of Assyria will tell you that she had commerce raised to a very high point, and that because these important cities were great commercial centers, she attacked and destroyed them one by one so that they could no longer be commercial competitors. Exactly as these Jews induced Britain to try to destroy Germany so that Germany couldn't be a commercial competitor. It runs in the blood of these Jews all down through the centuries. For that 700 years, Assyria was the dominant power in Western Asia. Nobody really seriously challenged it except Egypt on a few occasions, and Egypt got thoroughly whipped when they tried. The final overthrow of this ancient Assyrian Empire came about 606 BC. The Medo-Persians, the same people who later took Babylon, the Medo-Persians, together with their allies, the Scythians, and we know the Scythians were the people of 10-tribed Israel, who lived in the region around the south end of the Caspian Sea. The Medo-Persians and the Scythians finally overran Assyria, captured its great capital city, Nineveh, and the old empire came to an end. And yet the Bible continues to give prophecies that look thousands of years in the future, talking about Assyria and the Assyrians and what they're going to do. Which shows, therefore, that while a particular city has been burned and destroyed, that the people and the ideas that made that city are still continuing. The same thing is true with Babylon. Long after Babylon had fallen, the Bible still continues to make prophecies that go into the future even beyond our time, talking about Great Babylon, and it is talking about the Babylonian economic system. Now, Babylon became a colony of Assyria, and they were taught the Assyrian commercial and economic schemes, and they learned it well and they improved upon it. Until today, you find that the Bible is using Babylon as symbolic of this satanic craft in the way of commerce, economics. And it is using Assyria as symbolic of this same people's brutality and cruel. After the fall of ancient Assyria, the survivors, they didn't dare stay around there to face the vengeance of the people whom they had ruled with such cruelty in all the surrounding countries. They knew what that would mean. The survivors fled for their lives, the only direction they could go. They scooted north, right up around the shores of the eastern end of the Black Sea, and they got into southwestern Russia, into the provinces of Georgia and the Ukraine. And it is worth noting, perhaps, that it is exactly from these areas that both Stalin and Khrushchev came. Well, 606 BC marked the end of the ancient Babylonian Empire, and that, in its old site, never was revived. So when the Bible is talking about Assyria in the days that we ourselves are living, it means that those people are still here, that they are still up to their old tricks, that they are still going to behave with the same commercial greed and rapacity, and they're still going to behave with the same utterly depraved cruelty and brutality. And if you just bother to read your daily papers, censored as they are, you find that going on today. Of all the prophecies in the Bible, only a few dealt with what we like to call Bible times, times ending with the days of Jesus Christ. Those few, of course, were fulfilled with extreme precision. But the great bulk of the prophecies had nothing to do with Bible times. They had to do with our own times, which they called usually the latter days, or sometimes, speaking of a little farther advanced into it, the last days. As examples of how these things the Bible tries to bring to our attention, note that in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, Paul says this: "They are written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the age has come." And you people who come here know that we are watching the breakup of this age. Let's go back to Daniel, the source of many remarkable prophecies which definitely deal with our own age. And let's hear what the angel who brought him those prophecies says. Daniel 8, verse 17. "Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be revision." That's what he was talking to Daniel about. Let's go on to chapter 8, verse 19. "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be." Then chapter 10, verse 14. "Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days." And Bible times were not even remotely approaching the latter days yet. Then finally, Daniel 12, verses 9 to 10. The angel tells him, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." You know, that's why I feel secure in giving details in these talks, knowing that they are overheard by a spy. Because the Bible itself assures me that none of the wicked shall understand, so they strain their ears in vain. Again, Jeremiah 30, verse 24. "The fierce anger of Yahweh shall not return until he shall have done it, and until he shall have performed the intents of his heart. In the latter days ye shall consider it." Now is the time we should be studying these prophecies and seeing what they hold out for us, because they give us warning of the events that are coming. Now, if you say these things are prophesied and are therefore inevitable, the answer is that they're only inevitable because our own stupidity and cowardice allows them to happen after we've been warned not to allow it. What did Jesus Christ say about the servants who were to remain in charge of his goods until his return? Occupy until I come, hiding under the bed while his enemy comes and steals everything is not occupying. Now let's get back to these hook-nosed Jew Assyrians that we traced into Russia. Incidentally, in regard to the Jews, as probably many of you know, the Jews themselves call the Palestinian Jews Sephardim and the Slavic Jews Ashkenazi. The Sephardic Jew is likely to be taller, somewhat more slender of build, and with a longer skull. The Ashkenazi Jew is apt to be short, thick, heavy built, and more bullet-headed. But fortunately, most of them have that mark of Cain, the hook nose. Note these prophecies about Assyria now, which never took place in ancient times, and which therefore must still be future. Here's one that means a lot to us. It's Isaiah 10, verses 5, well, through 25. I'm skipping a little bit in it, but it'll do you good to read the whole 20 verses. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand is mine indignation. This is God speaking now through Isaiah. I will send him against an hypocritical nation. And, note that now, he's talking about two, a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit, he means not so, neither does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations not a few. Wherefore it shall come to pass that when Yahweh has performed his whole work upon, and now note this coupling of two different things with an and, his whole work upon Mount Zion and Jerusalem. Now if he was just talking about Jerusalem, that would include the ancient Mount Zion. So when he takes them up separately, he's talking about Mount Zion in our own day, which is the seat of government of the principal Israel peoples today. It shall come to pass that when Yahweh has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. And the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his holy one for a flame. And it shall burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. Remember when we were discussing Christ's parables, the one about the owner of the vineyard, you know, who let it out to tenants or husbandmen and looked for the rent. And then when they killed his servants and finally even killed his son when he sent him for the rent. You remember he said, I'll break down the walls and let the cattle trample it down and so forth. And he said, briars and thorns grow up in it. Well, now that's exactly what happened, because when the people of Israel were gone and the Jews came in and took over, they were the briars and thorns. So here's what it's talking about again. It shall burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh, God of hosts, O my people that dwell in Zion. Now you know Zion was only some 200-300 yards across. You couldn't have many people dwelling there, if you're talking about the Mount Zion in Jerusalem. But he's talking now about Zion in the sense of the organized nations of Israel today. O my people that dwell in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. For yet a very little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. And it shall come to pass in that day that his burden shall be taken away from off thy shoulder, and his yoke from off thy neck, and the yoke shall be destroyed because of the anointing. Now this was written in 713 B.C. Now remember that the Assyrians, the ones who conquered and deported the 10-tribe northern kingdom of Israel, finished the conquest in 721 B.C. and finished the deportation earlier than 715 B.C. So all this threat about the Assyrian coming in to attack couldn't apply to the old-time Assyrian Empire attacking the people of Israel, because that was all over. Now let's see what he's talking about here. He speaks of an hypocritical nation, for one thing, to be attacked. And then he says, the people of my wrath. Well, that hypocritical nation certainly describes us to a T, doesn't it? We let the Jews run us for their profit and our detriment, and cause us to serve Satan instead of God. We let ourselves be pushed into a war to break down and destroy Christian civilization in Europe, to destroy the only Christian power strong enough to bar the way of Russia and Asiatic communism. And we did it on the hypocritical pretense that we were supporting the vilest tyranny that the world has ever known, Soviet Russia. We were supporting that against Hitler and Mussolini because they were dictators. Well, now say anything you want to against Hitler and Mussolini, but the fact remains that in their worst qualities, they still were a lot better than Stalin and his best. And our government has never been against a dictator if he was red, no matter how cruel he was. Remember, we supported Stalin when we knew all his bestialities. Remember, we murdered some of the German officers under the false claim in the war trials that they were guilty of the Katyn massacre of thousands of Polish officers, when we knew, because we had the positive evidence in our government's hands, that they had nothing to do with it. They hadn't occupied that area until long after the massacre was done by the Russians. We support Tito of Yugoslavia, who is every bit as vicious and brutal as Stalin. He's just a small imitation of the real thing. We support the communist regime in Poland, in Bulgaria, and Romania. Oh yes, a lot of your tax dollars are going there, you know. We have given Tito's communism pretty close to $3 billion of your money now. Do we disapprove of dictators? No. Only when they're anti-communist. A hypocritical nation, yes, and no wonder God is going to take us to the woodshed for a little very much needed sand. Then the people of my wrath, who are they? Well, the Bible tells you that very, very plainly. All you need to do is turn to the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. And I like particularly to use the Old Testament on these things because the Jews give lying, hypocritical lip service to the Old Testament. Actually, they hate and detest it as much as they do the New Testament, but to keep up their fraudulent pretense that they're Israel, they give lip service to the Old Testament. So I like to identify them out of the Old Testament and show how God has prophesied their fate out of the Old Testament, because if they claim to recognize it, then let them go read what they claim is their book. You know, God starts out the book of Malachi, first chapter, he says, "Were not Esau and Jacob brothers? And yet Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated." And he goes on to tell something about Esau. And if you're wondering who Esau is, I will refer you to the Jewish Encyclopedia, article Edom, which concludes with these words: "The Edomites are found today in modern Jewry." He goes on to say of these Edomites, they will say, "Aye, they are impoverished, but we will go back and rebuild the ancient ruins." You know what they're saying over in Palestine today? They're impoverished enough that they aren't spending their own millions, they're spending yours. He said, "Yes, they will build, but I will throw down. And they will be called the border of wickedness, and the people against whom Yahweh hath indignation forever." How could you make it more emphatic than that? So, as we're going to see a little bit later, the people of his wrath will come in for something of this too. Now, not all the people of Russia are of the Assyrian type. The masters of it, almost exclusively, are these hook-nosed Jews. That's true. Then you have some Russians who are white. They're not Israelite. They're not Anglo-Saxon. They perhaps are Adamic, but they are Japhetic. They are not Semitic like the Anglo-Saxons. And then they have some out-and-out Mongolians. When I was at Stanford University, I remember the professor of Slavic languages and literature there, Professor Ross. A tall man, a somewhat tan in complexion, with high cheekbones and slant eyes. In other words, he was almost a Manchurian. But he was Russian. So you will find the mixture of them. But Russia today is completely under the control of these Assyrian Jews. In other words, Russia is the weapon in the hand of the Jew with which he attacks us. Now let's go on to another one here.